This show was previously broadcast live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Seed Institute, an enlightening and positive forum exploring the world's religions and spiritual practices in an effort to better understand each other, promote tolerance, and foster human unity. We present views and experiences of the world's religions and spiritual belief systems as an on-air classroom, helping listeners gain insight into religious and spiritual practices around the world, and to help people find the tools and inspiration for their own spiritual development. I'm your host, Carol Hallenbeck. The 19th century poet and artist William Blake once wrote in a poem, "To see a world in a grain of sand, and a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, and eternity in an hour." In 2005, the Dalai Lama, Tibet spiritual leader, invited us to see the universe in a single atom, a book he wrote on the importance of science in the modern world. In it, he shares his view that the studies of science and Buddhism have a similar goal, that of seeking truth. And he called for a new age of studies for his monks, one that includes modern science as part of the spiritual curriculum. One result is the Emory-Tibet Partnership, which we will be discussing today with two very special guests. Geshe Lobsang Tenzin Negi is senior lecturer in Emory University's Department of Religion. He also serves as director of the Emory-Tibet Partnership, a multidimensional initiative founded in 1998 to bring together the foremost contributions of the Western scholastic tradition and the Tibetan Buddhist sciences of mind and healing. Born in a small Himalayan kingdom adjoining Tibet, he began his training at the Institute of Buddhist Dialectics and continued his monastic education in South India, where he received his Geshe Larampa degree in 1994. Geshe Lobsang completed his PhD at Emory University in 1999. He has represented Tibetan Buddhism at numerous interfaith forums and conferences, including the Gethsemane Encounter, a historic Buddhist-Christian dialogue. He has lectured on Tibetan Buddhist philosophy, psychology, meditation, and the mind-body connection in universities and institutions around the world. In the summer of 2009, he inaugurated the Tibetan Mind-Body Sciences Summer Study Program abroad with Emory biologist Dr. Ari Eisen. Dr. Ari Eisen is a senior lecturer in biology and the Institute for Liberal Arts, director of the program in Science and Society, and associate faculty in the Ethics Center at Emory University, where he has been since 1990. Dr. Eisen received his PhD in biochemistry from the University of Washington at Seattle. He has taught research ethics for a decade and publishes in the basic science of gene regulation and in science teaching, research ethics education, and interdisciplinary education. His science and religion columns appear frequently in religiondispatches.org. His most recent projects include developing and teaching a comprehensive science curriculum to the Tibetan monks and nuns in exile in India, and editing, with Gary Lederman, a two-volume work, Historical and Contemporary Issues in Science and Religion, due out later this year. He is currently working on textbooks for the Tibetan Monk Project. Welcome, both of you, and thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Why don't we begin by telling the story simply of how this program came about at Emory, and also including your own involvement in it?
Yes.
Ari?
I can begin.
Thank you.
Lobsang is here too, yeah?
Yes.
Okay. Well, the relationship with Emory and Tibetan nation, the Dalai Lama, goes back over a decade, and really, I think, took root with my colleague, Bob Song, who's here to talk to us today also. He, after getting his PhD at Emory, has stayed on as faculty in the religion department. And through conversations with His Holiness the Dalai Lama and others, it became clear that all the Tibetan monks and nuns in exile, there's some 20,000 in India, had a need for integrating modern science curriculum into their ancient curriculum that they've been studying, and Lob Song himself studied for many years. This was kind of a vision of the Dalai Lama to bring contemporary science into that curriculum, and he requested that Emory do that. So over the last several years, for the first couple of years, 2-3 years, we were trying to figure out how to do that, because it was kind of a challenging thing for a bunch of non-Buddhist, non-Tibetan scientists halfway around the world to figure out how best to do that. How do you start teaching people who are very wise and bright but haven't been exposed to science or math? And so we began interviewing, inviting people to Emory, interviewing monks who had spent time in both the West and the East, talking to Americans who had become monks, scientists who had talked to monks, and gradually, over a couple of years, began to develop a curriculum, which we've now begun the very early stages of putting in place in Dharamsala.
It sounds almost as though the first challenge was a cultural one.
Very much, and it's a continuing challenge, but I think we've come a long way in the 3 or 4 years that we've been thinking about this. Certainly just the opportunity to go. Once we were able to go and interact with the monks and nuns, we had a much better vision and much better view of what was needed from both sides, from the monks and nuns side and from our side.
Geshe La, are you there?
Yes, I am here. So,
yes, hello.
hello. My phone went dead for some reason.
Yes,
earlier.
Well, we're glad you're with us. You see, it's impermanence in all things, right?
That's right.
We were just discussing the early stages, the beginning of the partnership of Emory College to teach at the Dalai Lama's behest the modern science, to adding that to the spiritual curriculum of his monks. And we've always understood the Dalai Lama to be interested in Western culture and in integrating many aspects of it. Can you share a little of your own journey of the beginning of this program and how you became involved?
Certainly. Actually, that you're right that His Holiness the Dalai Lama, from the very early age, of course, had a great fascination for science. And as we read and hear from him, that how he was fascinated by the various tools like telescopes and like that, and he used to explore with those tools. So, over the years, certainly he has continued with that. And then when finally he had an opportunity to meet the other scientists, great scientists like Francisco Varela and others, who were very much interested in exploring the spiritual world as well. They formed together an institute called the Minor Life Institute, and through that, for last 20 some years, there have been a tremendous collaboration in understanding various meditative states or the various contemplative states like mindfulness, compassion, and things like that, how they can be understood scientifically, and also what kind of benefits these mental states would have on our health and emotional or physical health, but also sort of kind of the social level as well. So this work, that the contemplative science, if you will, it's really for large part due to His Holiness the Dalai Lama's own personal interest to integrate the inner science of mind, which the Tibetan Buddhist tradition is very strong, and the the modern science that explores the external world of physics and so forth.
Kind of
my own interest in this work actually was inspired by His Holiness the Dalai Lama himself. Back in 1986, when I was still a monk and studying at Depung Rosling Monastery in South India, there was a conference where His Holiness the Dalai Lama encouraged the young monks and nuns who spoke some English to really explore the scientific models of mind and emotions, because he felt that these two traditions will have a lot in common to understand and to advance the understanding of our inner world of thoughts and emotions, which would have a great benefit to humanity. So that kind of stuck with me. And then when I had the opportunity in 1991 to enroll at Emory's graduate school in the Institute of Liberal Arts, I was very fortunate to find a mentor in Dr. Robert Paul. He then became the dean of the Emory College, but he himself was a great scholar of Tibetan Buddhist tradition, but also a great anthropologist and psychoanalyst. He really mentored me, you know, in looking, kind of forming my own PhD program in the field of emotions. And so as I studied more, it became very clear that the modern scientific knowledge that is developing or advancing now in of emotions and the mind is a very kind of the fascinating kind of the field where the Buddhism certainly can come together and you know, collaborate and perhaps make contributions. And in 2006, my good friend Geshe-la Hagtor is the director of Library of Tibetan Works and Archives in Dharamsala, an organization that is responsible for overseeing science education for Tibetan monks and nuns. When he came to Atlanta, he requested Emory University's help on behalf of His Holiness the Dalai Lama to develop a comprehensive and sustainable science curriculum for Tibetan monks and nuns, which Emory University accepted. And you know, the professors, like to my very good friend Dr. Ari Eisen and others, they came on board, and that's how, you know, this program known as Emory Tibet Science Initiative to develop the science program for Tibetan monks and nuns, it began. And we have so far offered 2 years of course to the monks and nuns, and then we will be traveling to Dharamsala again in May, June, to offer the third year course.
Well, this is a very important project, of course. Ari told us earlier that the first challenge was one of culture and perhaps language, both of which, of course, can be addressed with interpreters and you know, encounters with each other. But may I ask you, what viewpoint of science do the monks bring to these new studies? That is, do Buddhists have a kind of creation story that explains the world and how it came to be, as the Judeo-Christians have the story of Genesis?
Well, I mean, there are lots of areas where the scientific knowledge would be very, you know, important for compare and perhaps even inform the knowledge for you know, Buddhist knowledge. In terms of the Genesis, the Buddhist understanding or the Buddhist tradition does not locate the kind of the formation of this world in some, you know, in exactly the same way as the Judeo-Christian tradition does. Model or the Buddhist view of the universes or the world, it's rather kind of complex and you know, based on the like the huge time scale, and it maintains that the world systems are formed, what are known as the space particles, and you know, that we cannot really locate in a time that we can calculate right now in our you know, that recent because in other words, it's not like in a matter of, you know, million or billion years, but you know, a much longer period for the universe itself. And it believes in multiple universes, multiple dimensions. You know, that our one solar system or world system could form at a certain time due to the multitude of factors, because the Buddhist principle of what is known as the dependent origination, you know, the principle of dependent origination, it maintains that that everything, whether it's universes or ourselves as individuals or any single event, you know, that exist, it is the product of multitude of different factors, and it's in that context that the world system is understood. But certainly, modern science, you know, when it comes to the cosmology, you know, that was about the specific, like whether it's a Big Bang or you know, that how the universe is expanding or not, it's expanding, and how the black holes and the, you know, that the, all the various kind of the structures of the galaxies and so forth. These are very, very important knowledge that I think that complement the...
Excuse me, one of the more amazing things that the Dalai Lama has said is, along your questions, Carol, is that if modern science demonstrates conclusively with strong evidence some facts, some information, then Buddhism should change and carefully look at that information and even go so far as changing their views if that science is accepted, if the proofs are strong enough. It's, kind of, it's an amazingly enlightened statement that you wouldn't hear very many religious leaders make.
Well, the following year, after Geshe had his inspiring time with the Dalai Lama at a conference in 1987, there was a supernova that inspired me. Along my journey of faith, and while the arguments separating science and faith seem to be, you know, raging on century after century, as a minister, I have found that science informs my faith, and particularly the space sciences, as they allow for great freedom of imagination. And as a college student, I studied astronomy at New York University. On our first day, Professor Brown announced that while we would be exploring foundational scientific concepts from Newton to Niels Bohr to Einstein, we would proceed with the attitude that something entirely new could happen tomorrow and that everything we know might be wrong. And I loved it. I thought we were off to a great start. And I took joy and comfort in that unknowing, if that makes sense.
That really parallels life.
That there's a mystery greater than no matter what we can try to learn, even as we enjoy it with the best tools possible. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Well, that, absolutely. That's very true. I mean, that our knowledge is, you know, quite limited still. There's much more to know, and what we know now may, you know, it, as you said, that it can be, that tomorrow there may be a different, you know, form of information that may shed yet completely different light on what the realities are.
Yeah, and I think neuroscience, modern neuroscience, is kind of parallel to the cosmology, you know, the physics of the 20th century, the neuroscience of the 21st century is analogous in that we're realizing many of the things, ironically, using modern ways of looking at it that Tibetans have known for a long time, just from a different approach, from a different kind of science, Tibetan Buddhist, that is, for a long time. So that neuroscience is very similar. You know, what could happen and what's out there and what we understand, potentially be understood one day, but it's far from being understood. It's just up to the imagination. So I think that's another thing that attracted, I know that's another thing that attracted the Dalai Lama, because he's talked to many neuroscientists and encouraged the monastics to engage in research and to the benefit, I think, of both Tibetan Buddhism and Western science.
The environment seems to be ripening in general toward this convergence from both sides, it seems to me. You know, on one end, there's, you know, intelligent design coming into the picture, trying to sort of bridge this gap. And on the other side is technology catching up with instruments that can actually, as you, you know, just said, can support what the Tibetans have known such, you know, for so many years. Ari, you said it took you a while to put together a curriculum. What are the monks learning?
Well, it's still evolving, but what was requested specifically by the Dalai Lama was to focus on neuroscience, the life sciences in general, and cosmology and physics. So that's where we've been focusing, and I can speak, for example, about life sciences. That's what I've been most involved in. We started with evolution. So it's basically a five-year curriculum. We're taking two groups of 30 to 50 monks and nuns through about a five-year curriculum, which we then hope will become integrated across all monasteries and nunneries. So we've selected monks and nuns from as many different monasteries and nunneries as we can. So, for example, in life sciences, we started with evolution because that underlies everything in the life sciences, and then moved into an understanding of cells and genes, and then we're going to do the, you know, molecular level stuff, and then we move into this coming summer, actually, into the bigger picture, physiology, how do our organs and bodies work together, and eventually we'll move up into the population, environmental, big question areas like disease and the environment and ecology. So it's not too different, you know, from what I just said, from what you might teach in an undergraduate curriculum. But of course, there's many differences because the starting points are different, and you want to use, we'd like to use examples and engage the monks and nuns from their own world, obviously, and not, you can't use analogies that you would use, or you can't use examples that you would use with American undergraduates. So we've had a lot of fun. That's where the most fun happens, is where you take something like sensing, like the way we taught cells and genes was through the idea of sensing. How do our bodies sense something? And we actually use bacteria as an example, because bacteria, as far as the Western scientist is concerned, can sense their environments and respond to their environment. But that brings in an interesting question in Buddhism, because if bacteria can sense their environment, does that mean that they're conscious beings? If they're conscious beings, that means they could be they can become reincarnated, or you could become reincarnated as a bacterium. It brings up this huge philosophical question, starting with just the simple cellular question of, can bacteria sense? So we actually had the monks and nuns isolate their own bacteria and try and answer that question. So that would be an example of how we had a lot of fun with, you know, something from a very different perspective than you would do with an American undergraduate. And,
yes, indeed.
It was interesting. In the end, they were split 50-50, monks and nuns, on the question of whether bacteria could sense or not, after we really swept through the details and did the experiments. So that was kind of rewarding as a teacher, when you're students are split 50-50 after they thought through something
yes.
so carefully. That's a good sign.
Yeah, there's discernment going on. That's good. Did you find also, was there any initial resistance coming regarding this program? Any fears that the traditional studies of the monasteries were going to be diluted or changed at all?
Well, that certainly there was a concern. I would not particularly say resistance, primarily because His Holiness the Dalai Lama was the one who encouraged this inquiry, and therefore that the Tibetans that wholeheartedly kind of believe and follow His Holiness. But certainly among the monastic elders, there were some concerns, primarily because if you don't know exactly how the scientific knowledge is, transmitted, and what that can do to the traditional education and the knowledge. So I think that there were some concerns, but it's amazing that it, within a few years, you know, that concern is almost not there. I mean, that actually the monastics are very excited about studying modern science while pursuing their own traditional education.
Yeah, your question, Carol, is another example of something I never would have thought of when we were trying to sort through this before we started actually going and teaching. One of the gentlemen who had been, actually was an American, but had become a monk and is a scientist also, he pointed out something interesting that emphasizes these cultural differences. He said that one way to look at science from, if you're a monk, especially one that had escaped from China or Tibet under Chinese rule, was to somehow he put on the same level science as with scientism, which some put with communism in China. You know, this idea of taking spirituality and religion out of everything, this philosophical, the scientism. So if that, if you did that in your mind, you could see why a Tibetan would be a bit leery, whether they were a monk or not, they'd be a bit leery about science, right?
Right.
So that was something I had, never would have thought of, but.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think that because the Chinese authorities in Tibet, within Tibet, kind of used the scientific discoveries to point to the Tibetans that the Tibetan form of knowledge was kind of the super, the superstitious or the not based on logic and reasoning and not scientific. Therefore, it's primitive. So I think that that could have caused some concern, but that approach from the Chinese authorities, I think it itself is erroneous. I mean, because the science, if you really take the science as it is, it does not get into whether there is reincarnation, it is valid or not. I mean, that science has to base its claims based on make its claims based on observation and the examination in the field of like reincarnation like that. I mean, that I don't think that at this point the science would really address whether it's valid or invalid.
No, and if you take something like evolution, I was talking to one of the monks. Some of the monks are pretty fluent in English. Most of them are not, but I was talking to one that was, and I was asking him about evolution when we were first teaching. And I said, well, what if something like evolution, which might be at odds with what you thought before, what are you thinking when I'm telling you this is Darwin's ideas and this is evolution? And he basically said, well, if you can convince me and give me good evidence and good support for your argument, and I can see it as being stronger than what I thought previously, then I'll accept your argument. So it's a very scientific thing to say, right?
Yeah, that's what His Holiness's position is also. I mean, he has, publicly at the scientific conference in Washington, D.C. several years ago, and he has said that many times, but at that conference also he said that any concept that Buddhists maintain if through the scientific examinations, if they are proven wrong, kind of conclusively, that the Buddhists should give up that claim, those concepts. Mm-hmm. But it's important to keep in the mind also that the lack of evidence is not the evidence of its lack. I mean, it's invalidity. So that's where if there is a very clear evidence, that demonstrates that some claims that Buddhists make are invalid, the conclusive evidence there, the Buddhists have no problem in giving it up. I mean, that because the entire Buddhist philosophy, I mean, its foundation is based on inquiry also, like science. So as His Holiness the Dalai Lama often says, that the greatest authority for Buddhists, like in the science, is the empirical evidence. And the second part is logic and reason. And only at the kind of last resort is the confidence or the belief. So so in that way, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, Buddhist has its own kind of the tradition to give the credibility to the empirical, you know, evidence.
Yes, because the ultimate goal is the seeking of truth.
Exactly.
This is fascinating.
It's such a more open, different way of looking at cultures coming together, science and different worldviews coming together than what you often see, which is either one swallowing up the other or one ignoring the other.
Right.
But to me, you know, when I first got involved with this project, I did it because it was cool, because Lapsang is my friend and it sounded neat. But it's really matured in my mind into this, into what I see as a great model for bringing different cultures together. I guess you could use the word globalization. If the world is going to be, if the world is going to be interacting much, much more, the cultures are going to be integrated more, how can we do that so that the best is gained from all different cultures and one doesn't swallow up the other, right? And I think that's one of the places where the Dalai Lama saw what was coming and realized to save Tibetan Buddhism, right, it had to engage science, it has to engage culture. And then for us, our challenge is, well, how do we not come in as scientists and say, this is the way things are, this is the way things are, but and not swallow things up, but to, in return, and this is where I've learned, is what we learn from the monks and nuns. And we learn how to be open, how to receive their ideas and integrate with ours. And it's really a two-way street, this project. It can very easily be seen, I think, by somebody who's listening as, you know, the scientists going in and telling, the Western scientists going in and telling the monks, this is the way it is. It's not that at all. It's very much a conversation. There's a lot of interaction in both directions where we're learning this ancient knowledge that way much significantly predates anything science has to offer in both directions. And from that comes something new and different, perhaps better. I don't want to put any value on it, but certainly something new and different as far as understanding. So I've really come to this has really become probably my favorite thing to do with my mind.
Well, Dr. Eisen, I'd like to discuss more of that maturing and integration and mutual relationship. We're going to take a short break right now. Please stay with us. We like to showcase new and interesting music on Godspeed, and we're going to take a few minutes now. This piece is called Fluid by the artist Kenji Akira from the album Shimizu Requiem. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Godspeed Institute. I'm your host, Carol Hallenbeck. We're speaking with Geshe Lobsang Tenzin Negi and Dr. Ari Eisen, Director and Professor of the Emory-Tibet Partnership. Welcome back, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Ari, you were just leading off getting into the area of relationship, and I'm wondering if we can delve a little more into that, because, you know, in the end, it's all about encounter and relationship and moving forward together, hopefully. And I know that the Dalai Lama has been concerned about isolation of Tibet in the modern world. Isolation can be experienced in so many ways. Even Americans just being on the computer a lot is a new form of isolation. Can we discuss a little bit how the program is helping to bridge cultures and technology in a new world?
I mean, there's a lot of interesting things that have happened along the line of relationships and bridging cultures. One, when you're at the university, you're very much involved in your own tiny little world, your own department, your own intellectual space. One interesting huge side benefit for this program from those of us at Emory and other universities that have worked on this project is how we've gotten to know each other better, because it's a unique teaching environment where we go and teach for weeks at a time in a very intensive place, monks and nuns, students who are very, very engaged, very listening to our every word. And meanwhile, with all the teachers, we're eating together, thinking together, living together, talking moment to moment about how we're teaching, how we could do it better, how we could do it differently. So I have benefited personally from both relationships with monks and nuns, which I can talk more about in a minute, but also with my own colleagues, which was unexpected. And then with the monks, so that's I think, really helped us understand how to be better educators and better teachers, because we have this intense relationship with each other and with the monks and nuns. Working with the monks and nuns is a real experience. I've taught at many different places, people of all different ages, but I've never taught to the people who are sitting on the floor, cross-legged, wrapped in 100-degree temperatures. Their attention is totally wrapped and engaged with you. And then having to have everything translated, every few sentences, everything is translated into Tibetan. The combination of factors really changes the relationship. In some ways, it takes it longer to get to know your students because they're from such a different place. But because I'm working with the same group of 35 or so monks and nuns, 2 years now, it seems like many more years, just sitting in that room for 6 hours a day, for basically doing a semester's worth of material in 1 week, we've really got a social bond. And In one way, it's harder to get to know your students. In another way, you get to know them better because you're getting to know them in two different languages, in two different cultures, in two different ways. And we spend a good hour at the end of every day just sitting there, all of us, and talking, all the students and the teachers, because we often teach two of us together, just talking about what we did that day and what that knowledge means and what questions the monks have and what questions we have for them. And in some ways an ideal student-teacher relationship where the students are almost like your peers and sometimes you're almost their students. So it's really been, I mean, even beyond the differences, it's the likenesses, the similarities that have brought us together as people. And I email the monks and nuns and they email me back and send pictures when they're off in southern India and around the world during, we've become friends. So even at this very, as you said, everything's about relationships. And then layered on top of that are these amazing cultural co-learning experiences back and forth between and among the students and the teachers. So, we are talking about cells and genes and things that might bore a lot of people, but it's not boring at all. It's very engaging for both the audience and, if you will, the students and me, because we're integrating it into this rich cultural context.
Doctor, how has it affected you, perhaps personally? I recall reading in one of your articles that you know, the academic world might support and fundraise for religious goals, but certainly not be religious or spiritual. And you mentioned that in almost a longing way for more balance.
Yeah, it's a tricky space, right? Especially for a state institution, and especially in a country that supposedly has a separation of church and state, or, you know, professes that, and there's a value in that too. We probably swung too far away from that to the point where it's often, within academia, it's often thought to talk about what you believe personally is thought anathema, you know, a dangerous thing. Don't do it. Don't talk about what you believe, even if you phrase it in a certain way. I think that's gone a little too far. I'm not pushing for any kind of inculcation of ideas or anything, but I think there are certain points and times where what you believe can add a lot to the conversation. And it certainly, by definition, underlies a lot of why you're doing what you do. So actually, Geshe-La and I have taught courses together where we try and address some of these issues about why we believe what we do, using medicine and healing from the Eastern and Western perspectives as a way in. So yes, I think you're right. You picked up on one of my things. I think that our own personal beliefs and ideas are important, and probably even more so the students, especially the undergraduates. They're right at a point in their lives where they're trying to figure out what they do believe, and to try and pretend they're not.
And that's the age. That's when that journey happens.
Yeah, exactly. And to try and pretend they're not, or to help engage them with our own experiences. Admittedly, it can be challenging, and there are places where I can see, but that's not, to me, that's part of what education should be doing, is addressing those underlying beliefs. How do they fit into your worldview? So I don't know what you think about that, Lopsang.
No, I think that programs like this certainly help bridge that gap.
Right.
The connections are many, but also on intellectual level also. For too long, science and religion have basically gone separate ways. But I think that there is a tremendous value in looking into these strengths from each side, because as human beings, we need to have more holistic kind of the understanding of life and ourselves, if we were to have greater happiness and well-being in the society. And I think that one of the things that's happening now, is because of the advancement in scientific technology, like this imaging in a machine like fMRI scanners and a decade or two ago, when scientists could not really see any kind of changes in the brain and the deeper kind of biochemicals and like that, when somebody goes through certain experience. Now with this scanning technology that you can basically see what's happening in your brain when somebody is going through an experience of compassion or mindfulness and like that. So I think that that's what has made possible at this age for scientists to really engage with the contemplatives to better understand what is happening when someone goes into this experience of compassion or the mindfulness, and what kind of benefits, health benefits, it will have. And when it comes to kind of addressing these issues, I think that the dialogue or kind of closer understanding and collaboration between these two cultures or the traditions is very, very worthwhile.
Yeah, for one of the monks to say to me, I'm studying modern science to help me understand my own Buddhism better. I think that pretty much sums it up. I mean, it's a statement that no Westerner, I don't think, would ever even be able to say or be able to shape that phrase, but I think if you think about it, it really made me literally stop. I was walking along talking to him, and it made me stop in my spot because I thought, well, that's it, isn't it? Nobody's trying to convert anybody to anything else. I think there's a certain sense of, you know, either or threat that science, you either have to be religious or a scientist, or there's a threat.
Yes.
Here. That's not it at all. It's much, you know, here was this young monk studying, and nobody was ever going to threaten his Buddhism, and he didn't even consider that. But what he saw was that knowledge and opportunity could help him understand what he was already believing. And that to me kind of sums up, you know, I don't want to romanticize monastics or anything like that. They're just people like we are. But I think if more of us could think about the world that way, it seems like it might be a good way forward.
Well, I think also, you know, the environment is ripening some from both sides. You know, on the one side of science, there's a, let's say, a, you know, popular book like, you know, The Tao of Physics,
right.
In which, you know, it's, the professor shows how the deeper you get into particle physics, the closer you get to Eastern philosophy.
Right.
And about illusion and impermanence. And then from the other side, then there's the, you know, people now beginning to explore the power of prayer in healing.
Right.
More openly. And
I think that's okay. If some people happen to look at them both and bring them together some way and think they're converging, that's fine. But that's not necessarily what will happen to me and what I've learned from this. To me, the most important thing is that you're open to exploring those things. Nobody's saying that they have to come together in the end or mean the same thing in the end. But you don't know. You don't know until you explore. And I think that's really what this project is about.
Right. And it seems to lead to empathy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And now I know Geshe has a lot of work involved in the study of compassion in health. And even with the NIH, there's a project. In the last, you know, 5 minutes or so that we have, would you like to share a little bit about that, about the role of compassion?
Yes, certainly. I mean, I think that, when the scientists began investigating or studying the different modes of meditation or the different kind of this inner states, they began with various meditations like mindfulness or TM, transcendental meditation from Eastern traditions. But I think that in the recent years, there have been increasing interest in also understanding this state known as compassion and empathy, because for our society, I think that that as fast as it is going, sometimes that we basically are losing kind of this social connectivity, and that affects our empathy and the compassion, and it contributes to whole sets of mental problems and the social problems. So I think the compassion, the exploring the benefits of compassion has been quite recent, but it's really growing. A number of universities like University of Wisconsin in medicine, Stanford University, Emory University, these three universities that I know in America are very kind of doing scientific research as to the benefits of compassion, to see how compassion, when it's trained, not as a kind of religious practice, it's a psychological kind of activity, if you will. But when you can train in that, what changes they bring about in terms of, on your hormonal level, even immune function, and the changes in the brain. Our own study here at Emory University, Dr. Charles Rezan, who is the director of mind-body program at Emory School of Medicine, and myself, we started doing this study with undergraduates 4 or 5 years ago, Our studies seem to kind of indicate that those who do train in compassion and this kind of compassionate attitudes, they seem to be better in coping with stress, kind of psychosocial stresses that can be measured in kind of immune, certain kind of immune cells like interleukin 6 or cortisol, the hormones, but also the subjective kind of the experience about that how connected you feel to towards others and your own level of anger or the those emotional reaction. All these things seem to get better if you are more compassionate towards yourself, towards others. Based from that studies that we did receive a grant for from NIH to expand this study for next 5 years. But this is only one of the places where it's happening. The other universities are also doing very fascinating kind of the work in the field of compassion and empathy. And compassion and empathy is something not just, those who are spiritually inclined or are doing it. Even just the biologists like Franz De Waal at Emory University, that's the, the very renowned biologist, his own, lifetime of work, it's also seemed, to be kind of directing towards the importance of empathy. And his recent book, like The Age of Empathy, makes a very strong case that how that empathy is something that we all seem to have the potential for developing. And if the empathy can be cultivated, how it will be good for our society.
In the last minute or so we have left, can I ask you briefly, what is your vision for this program with the Tibetan monks and nuns down the line? What is its journey? What do you see it doing in the world?
Well, I think that His Holiness the Dalai Lama, when he asked Emory's help in developing this program, the number one, he really wanted the monks and nuns to be very familiar with the scientific knowledge, whether we want or not. Science is a dominant form of knowledge at present. So, number one, to just be, to live in the modern world, to be aware with the modern, framework of kind of the world and the life and so forth. But more than that, the idea, I think that with this kind of program, we can, as Dr. Ari Eisen mentioned, that we can educate, across that the scientists who are going to, coming in contact with the monks and nuns, learn about, their ideas and so forth, something there may be, helpful, like the importance of compassion and so forth and so on. For the monks and nuns themselves, as they become aware of scientific concepts, scientific methodology and so forth, they themselves would be in a much better position to collaborate with the scientists. So I think that that of course there could be a lot of uncertainties it's just about that it's mainly about we really want to kind of inform cross culturally, cross traditionally, but also I think that there is a real opportunity in the future to bring the science and spirituality together in which that not every aspect every topic would be kind of shared by both traditions, but I think that some of the important parts, important aspects of our life, where the science and spirituality can come together and which can really make a big difference. His Holiness the Dalai Lama, in his book, the book that you mentioned, In the Universe in the Single Atom, he mentions that that today in the first decade of this 21st century, we have a real kind of the opportunity or potential to kind of bring these two traditions together and to in some ways address the kind of the issues that the humanity faces.
Thank you, Geshe La.
Dr.
Eisen, can you tell people where they can learn more about these programs if they'd like more information?
Sure, I would start just with tibet.emory.edu, and from there.
What was that again?
I'm sorry, Tibet. tibet.emory, that's E-M-O-R-Y, .edu, tibet.emory.edu, and from there you can read more about all the things that are going on between Emory and the Tibet Partnership, and also specifically about this program. There are links to the Emory Tibet Science Initiative.
Thank you. There's a lot to learn, and I'm sure people will be going there. Thank you both so much for joining us today. There's so much to discuss. Perhaps we can touch base again in the future to see how the program is going. I'd enjoy that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Geshe. Thank you, Dr. Eisen. And thank you for joining us for the Godspeed Institute today. I'm your host, Carol Hallenbeck. For more information, please visit www.godspeedinstitute.com. We'll be back next Sunday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time for another spiritual journey. Until then, Godspeed.